We'd like to welcome everybody out this morning. This is section 324. Is plural marriage required for exaltation? Before we get started, I'd like to tell everybody to please turn off your cell phones. And if you think they're off, please check them and make sure they're off. Because after lecturing someone yesterday afternoon, or everyone, my phone went off during the session. So if you think it's off, sometimes it's not. We'll be hearing today from Brian Hales, a doctor and an anesthesiologist at Davis Hospital and Medical Center. He is a member of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, an author of The Priesthood and Modern Polygamy, an LDS Perspective, and he is webmaster of www.mormonfundamentalism.com. After Brian presents his paper, we will be hearing from Ann Wild. Ann is co-author of Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage, and she is co-founder of Principal Voices, managing editor, and she is managing editor of Mormon Focus magazine. I'll turn the time over to Brian. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate all of you coming. As I was coming in, I heard a couple men talking, and he said, "Gosh, I've got such a quandary at 10 o'clock. There's Carolyn Pearson, there's Janice Allred, and there's Doug Fabrizio. I mean, I didn't even make the long list, you know, let alone the short list." And then I talked with Armin Moss yesterday about, what do you think about plural marriage? He says, "I'm sick of hearing about it." I was thinking I maybe should have called my parents to come, so at least there'd be somebody here to listen to us today. I'm grateful to have Ann here. I've known Ann for about 15 years and have the highest respect for her, and recognize her, the challenge to respond in 10 minutes to the amount of material that we're going to run through here in about 30. So we're going to start off by talking about the question, is plural marriage required for exaltation? I'd like to define for our discussion what is meant by plural marriage. Reuelen Allred taught in 1975 that sealing plural marriages without proper priesthood authority, quote, may give you polygamy, but as God lives, it doesn't give you celestial marriage, end quote. And I agree with Reuelen's assessment that we have to have proper priesthood authority in order to have a genuine plural marriage, according to our discussion today. In other words, living a polygamous lifestyle is not the same as authorized plural marriage. Section 132, verse 7, and I apologize for getting into the scriptures, but it says that there is one on earth at a time on whom the power and the keys of this priesthood are conferred. And then down in verse 18, it says that without the authorization from the one man, the plural marriage is not valid, neither of force, when they are out of the world. And I think this is key. As I've studied Mormon fundamentalism, I've identified three different things that seem to come together singly or together that may circumvent the need, at least in the minds of the individuals involved, circumvent the need for genuine priesthood authority. The first is sincerity. Joseph Musser taught this in 1935. He said, "Those of us who feel the need of a more definite direction from the Lord should take courage in the feeling that since we have dedicated all unto God and are executing all our energies to keep his commandments, the Lord must be pleased with our course, else he would set us right. No good father will permit his children who want to do right to go far astray." And Musser was a leader of the fundamentalists in 1935 when he said this. Personally, I think that this is somewhat naive, because false teachings can be embraced as sincerely as true teachings, and there's lots of religionists throughout the world who are very sincere, and they're flying airplanes into tall buildings and doing all kinds of things. I don't think sincerity is a shield against deception. The second concern has to do with tradition. There are some very powerful traditions, even among the Mormon fundamentalists. We're into two and three generations. In 1936, John Y. Barlow was asked if he claimed to hold the keys of the priesthood, which he answered in the negative. A week later, Joseph Musser, who was the second in seniority in the priesthood council, confessed that the Lord had not revealed to him who held the keys of the priesthood. Nevertheless, before and after 1936, thousands of Mormon fundamentalists have borne testimony that Barlow and Musser did indeed hold the keys of priesthood, which has created a very resilient and rugged tradition among Mormon fundamentalists. My third concern has to do with personal revelation. In my book, which will be out in the next month, I talk about a number of individuals. Here's 36 names, but these men are all, most of them are all polygamists, but they're all fundamentalists, and most of them are receiving different personal revelations, guiding people in a whole myriad of different directions. Conflicting personal revelations create confusion. For this reason, I believe plural marriage is regulated through the one man that we referred to earlier who holds the keys of sealing authority. What's interesting is the one man who holds the keys is mentioned in verse 7, verse 18 and 19 in section 132. But in conjunction with the discussion of this one man, we discover that verse 132, verse 8 says, "Behold, mine house is a house of order, saith the Lord God, and not a house of confusion." And then the Lord repeats himself 10 verses later in verse 18, saying, "My house is a house of order." I believe he's trying to make a point. In answering the question, is plural marriage required for exaltation? I think if we will just look at a history of plural marriage among religious societies since the beginning of recorded history, we can find the answer fairly readily. The scriptures teach that Abraham was commanded to take Hagar to wife. And that's the only place in the scriptures that I can find anyone being commanded to be a polygamist. And in fact, if you read the Old Testament version, it was Sarah who encouraged Abraham to do it, but section 132 said Abraham was commanded. If we look at the Old Testament, we find that polygamy was generally permitted but was not required. And then in the Book of Mormon, it was not permitted. And also, I believe in the New Testament time, though it's less clear, it was not permitted. Historian Jesse Ambry observed that polygamy was historically an option but not a requirement in Old Testament society. The question really comes up is, did the Nephites in the Book of Mormon practice polygamy? And the party line is, at least among Mormon fundamentalists, is that in fact the Nephites were polygamists. And then Joseph Musser in 1935 wrote that the Nephites were falling into the same error as David and Solomon, hence they must cease the practice of plural marriage until commanded otherwise by the Lord. And this is the general belief, that they had it and they abused it and it was taken away. But a more careful reading of the Book of Mormon reveals that sometime during his life, Lehi received the commandment of the Lord that they should have, save it were, one wife, and concubines they should have none. And then Lehi died between 588 and 570 BC. After Lehi's passing, Nephi reigned until he had died, which occurred between 544 and 421 BC. Then it was under the reign of the second Nephite king that the Nephites experimented with polygamy and were reminded of God's command of monogamy, which had been given decades earlier to Lehi. In their defense, the guilty Nephites justified their behavior not by saying, "Well, Lehi was a polygamist, so we get to be." They said, no, they cited the things that were written concerning David and Solomon upon the plates of brass. And my conclusion is that if Lehi or Nephi had been a polygamist, they would likely have mentioned it. And I further conclude, President George Q. Cannon said this, "The Nephites, according to all that has come down to us, were monogamists. This law was not given to them as far as we have any account. Yet they were a great and mighty people before the Lord. They had prophets and mighty men among them." My conclusion is that if righteousness is the primary criteria for the opportunity to practice plural marriage, then it seems that Lehi and Nephi should have been qualified. God's command to Lehi to marry monogamously shows that there are times when God will not permit polygamy, even if his chosen people are willing and worthy to practice it. Now the question comes up, did New Testament saints practice plural marriage? It's less clear. New Testament Christians had access to the sealing authority. It was held by Peter, who was the senior apostle. And yet there's no sign of plural marriage. We do have Paul teaching in two of his epistles that a bishop must be blameless, the husband of one wife. Now that's not conclusive, but if we look at the time when plural marriage was practiced at its peak during the Utah period, probably 1856 or 57, we discovered that the general membership were involved up to maybe 20-25%. But if we look at the leadership, the stake leaders and the bishops, the number reaches 60-75% of them were involved with plural marriage. And yet here we find Paul teaching that a bishop should have one wife. I really think that in the New Testament time it was not permitted. There's just no evidence of it. Now let's look at the restoration of the practice of plural marriage through Joseph Smith. In the early 1830s, while revising the Old Testament, Joseph Smith learned that plural marriage was a true principle, but he was not then allowed to practice it. But by 1841, Joseph Smith was commanded by an angel to enter into plural marriage, and during the next 3 years, members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles in Nauvoo were similarly commanded. In 1852, Brigham Young announced to the world that church members believed the principle of plural marriage and were practicing, and from that point on, it was considered a commandment to the Latter-day Saints. And then between 1852 and 1890, Latter-day Saints were taught by their leaders that plural marriage was then required by God. For example, Brigham Young taught in 1862, and these are sound bites, I've had to kind of cut them up, but you can go to the references, but he taught that polygamy is the only popular religion in heaven. John Taylor in 1879 taught it is a command of God. Wilford Woodruff in 1883 taught, I know that if we had not obeyed that law, we should have been damned. Lorenzo Snow in 1886 taught, I married because it was commanded of God and I commenced in plural marriage. Joseph F. Smith in 1878, and this is very popular in Mormon fundamentalist literature, he said, whoever has imagined that he could obtain the fullness of the blessings pertaining to this celestial law by monogamy has deceived himself. He cannot do it. So for church members living between 1852 and 1890, and this is my conclusion, and Ann probably has a different viewpoint, we'll get to hear that in a minute, but I believe that plural marriage was considered a commandment and a law to them, and was for them in many ways synonymous with the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, patriarchal marriage, and celestial marriage, because for them to comply with any of these, they needed to be involved with polygamy. However, in 1890, through Wilford Woodruff, who was then the one man holding the sealing keys, the Lord said, it is enough. And he removed the command, I believe. Wilford Woodruff taught that I wrote what the Lord told me to write. But, and this has been a point of books and very well-written articles, between 1890 and 1904, church presidents Wilford Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, and Joseph F. Smith permitted a few plural marriages each year. But in 1904, it was April, after coming back from the Smoot hearings, President Joseph F. Smith stopped authorizing new plural marriages. And by 1909, new polygamists were excommunicated from the church. So as I conclude, looking back at the religious history of plural marriage, I believe that there are times when it may be commanded, there are times where it may be permitted, and other times when it is not permitted. Plural marriage was commanded to Abraham, to certain church leaders, including Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, and to the Latter-day Saints between 1852 and 1890. Plural marriage was permitted in the Old Testament times and to the Latter-day Saints between 1890 and 1904. And these were all done secretly. A lot of ambiguity with these caused a lot of embarrassment to the church and even to the leadership today. But they were permitted. There's no question about that. Plural marriage was not permitted in the Book of Mormon, in the New Testament, I believe. In Joseph Smith, when he first learned about it, he learned it was a true principle, but the Lord said, you can't practice it now. And then the Latter-day Saints after 1904, I believe. Here's a chart just kind of summarizing what we've already talked about. It's from the book. It's in my book. My conclusion is then that religious history demonstrates that plural marriage is not universally commanded of God's followers. Concerning earthly marital practices, God has instructed, I will command my people to be monogamists or polygamists, all according to his will. And I believe that even church leaders who have practiced plural marriage have acknowledged that this is in fact the eternal truth. Brigham Young taught in 1871, a man may embrace the law of celestial marriage in his heart and not take the second wife and be justified before the Lord. John Taylor taught in 1881, if a man entered into the everlasting covenant with one wife, with full purpose of heart to keep the commandments and through circumstances is deprived of going further, he may be justified. President Wilford Woodruff in 1891 said the manifesto was just as authoritative and binding as though it had been given in the form of Thus Saith the Lord. In 1901, President Lorenzo Snow taught, some of the brethren are worrying about the matter of the 1890 manifesto and feel that they ought to have other wives. Brethren, do not worry. You will lose nothing. President Joseph F. Smith in 1897 taught, the doctrine is not repealed. The truth is not annulled. The law is right and just, now as ever. But the observance of it has stopped. The question comes up, is every man in the celestial kingdom a polygamist? And there's a pretty prevailing belief among Mormon fundamentalists that the answer is yes, and quite honestly among Latter-day Saints in general, church members, that the answer is yes. When God revealed that men and women are exalted as couples, he had to reveal plural marriage. Otherwise, he would have been an unjust God, because at the end of the judgment, a worthy woman might have been damned simply because she had no monogamous husband to eternally wed. And I believe this is the primary reason we have plural marriage in our theology. For every man in the celestial kingdom to be a polygamist would require twice as many worthy women as men. And there are more worthy women. There's no question about it if we look at the church and the world in general. But is the number 2-1? I don't think it is. But the problem is further compounded because in our theology, we believe that children dying before age 8 will grow during the millennium, be married by proxy, and exalted. Equal numbers of boys and girls provide the boys with their first wives. But we're talking billions of boys that die before the age of 8, and the question comes up, where will all of these extra second wives come for all of these exalted boys? But the problem is compounded further because Lauren Woolley implied, and this is a doctrine very prevalent among, say, the Kingstons, I think the FLDS, Warren Jess, I've heard has 70 or 80 wives because he married all his father's wives plus the ones he already had, that there's this idea that having more wives brings a better exaltation. In other words, a man with 3 wives won't have as great an exaltation as a man with 5 wives. A woman who's the 10th wife of a man with 10 wives will have a greater exaltation than a woman who's the 5th wife of a man with 5 wives. But this idea is not something I can trace back to Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, or John Taylor. Lauren Woolley, and this is just an interesting observation, I just put these in this morning, but Lauren Woolley himself was just a monogamist, except for the last 2 years of his life. This is Lauren here, kind of a dapper guy, and this is J. Leslie Broadbent and Joseph Musser. These were the leaders of the group. But these three men married these Kmetsch sisters. In fact, I think we have a descendant of this group here in with us. But this gal, Lucy, married Musser, and this gal, Anna, married Broadbent, and then I think she's in her 30s. Golda married Lauren. Unfortunately, these two gals were widows within 2 or 3 years because both Broadbent and Woolley would die relatively soon after this. But this is the only polygamous marriage for Lauren Woolley, even though he taught that to be president of the church, you had to have 3 wives, to be president of the priesthood, you had to have 5 wives, and to be the head of a dispensation, you had to have 7 wives, which is interesting. His father, incidentally, who most Mormon fundamentalists or many believe that he was the first non-church member to hold the keys of the sealing authority, John Woolley was really a polygamist for only 6 years of his life, and he was sealed only to one woman, making him a monogamist in eternity. But nevertheless, there is a very strong belief that the more wives you have, the better your exaltation among many Mormon fundamentalists today. I found this teaching from President Wilford Woodruff in 1888. He was writing to a Mormon bishop. He said, "You have asked some other questions concerning how many living wives a man must have to fulfill the law." Now, keep in mind, this is between 1852 and 1890. Wilford Woodruff said, "When a man, according to the revelation, married a wife under the holy order, which God has revealed, and then married another in the same way, so far as he has gone, he has obeyed the law. I know of no requirement which makes it necessary for a man to have 3 living wives at a time." The issue there is obedience, not how many wives and children we can have here on earth. Now, as I was putting this together, I asked myself, what if I had to present the opposite view? Anne's going to have 10 minutes to respond, which isn't the same thing, but if I wanted to present to everybody here an idea that we have to be polygamous to be fully exalted, what would I do? Well, the first thing I would do is that I would quote between 1852 and 1890 and then imply that these apply to every place in the world at any time. And we've already talked about some of the very strong declarations by church presidents during that period. The other 3 things I would do is quote 132, section 132, and say that it was all about polygamy. I would teach that plural marriage is an ordinance, and then I would quote the John Taylor 1886 revelation, which we'll talk about briefly. But first, the question is section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants strictly about plural marriage? We admit that the question Joseph Smith asked was about plural marriage. He asked the Lord about David and Solomon and having many wives. And the Lord gave an answer, and one of the verses of that answer says that if ye abide not the covenant, then ye are damned. Okay, that's kind of scary. But if we look at the whole revelation, we discover that plural marriage is not mentioned until verse 34. And everything before that is talking about marriage, but not plural marriage. Plural marriage is not mentioned. I believe that Joseph Smith answered a specific question, and he got from the Lord a very broad answer. He asked about polygamy. He got an answer that included polygamy but was not limited to it. And this was not without precedent. In 1833, Joseph Smith asked about tobacco use. And the Lord gave an answer. It's now section 89 of the word. It's called the Word of Wisdom. One verse of that section deals with tobacco use. The rest of it is a general health code that addresses tobacco use but is not limited strictly to it. And I believe that similarly, the Joseph Smith asked about polygamy, and the Lord gave the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, which includes plural marriage but is not limited strictly to it. The question also comes up, is plural marriage an ordinance? And a few fundamentalist authors have said that it is. And Joseph Smith said this. He said, where there is no change of priesthood, there is no change of ordinances. Question, is suspending the practice changing an ordinance? In fact, there is no priesthood ordinance of plural marriage. There is an ordinance where one man is sealed to more than, there is no ordinance where one man is sealed to more than one woman in one single event. Plural marriage, in fact, is a repetition of an ordinance. It's the ordinance of sealing wherein one man and one woman are joined together in eternal matrimony. The sealing ordinance, and this is important, does not reveal whether the man involved has been previously sealed to other women or whether those women are living or dead. President John Taylor testified in 1884 that there is no distinction between the authority used to seal a first marriage versus a polygamous marriage, a second or a third or fourth marriage. Same authority, same ordinance. Church presidents, and read this carefully, church presidents have allowed plural marriage sealings to occur continuously since 1841. Only after 1904, the man's other wives had to be deceased. The ceremony wouldn't have mentioned it. It wouldn't have revealed whether those wives were alive or dead. But the ordinances have been continued. The church has really lost nothing from my perspective. They're continuing to do these sealings. Now let's spend just a minute, and for those of you who don't have much history with Mormon fundamentalism, may find the next 5 minutes a little bit boring, and I apologize for that. But in 1886, John Taylor received a revelation, and I even wrote some things 10, 15 years ago doubting whether this was genuine. I believe that it is. This is it. We aren't going to try to read it here. This is just a copy, but there's two histories of it that are out there. The first one that we'll mention was first related 35 years after the fact by Lauren Woolley. Lauren Woolley remembered that back in 1886, there was an eight-hour meeting, and during that meeting, President John Taylor sat down and wrote the revelation, which was given to him by the Lord upon the question of plural marriage. At least that's what Woolley thought it was. President John Taylor had L. John Nuttall write 5 copies of the revelation, and then he gave each of us a copy, the 5 men who were, according to Lauren, given authority to seal marriages. Each of them received a copy of the revelation. And what's interesting is none of these 5 copies has ever been heard of or identified. It's quite obvious to me Lauren Woolley did not have his copy in 1912 when he remembered his and wrote his 1912 account. The other history of this document is from John W. Taylor, who is President Taylor's son, and he related this in 1911. He said, I found it on my father's desk immediately after his death when I was appointed administrator of his estate. And in this view, there's no evidence to support that John Taylor ever talked about this revelation with anyone before his death. But I believe that he genuinely did receive it. Here's the text of it here. We're not going to read the whole thing. There are, I think, 9 paragraphs there. Generally, Mormon fundamentalists are very certain that somewhere in those paragraphs, the Lord is saying that the practice of plural marriage could never be suspended. Here's Joseph White Musser's conclusion. He said, here in the 1886 revelation, the Lord very clearly and definitely says that in order to enter his glory, men must live the law of plural marriage. He makes no exceptions. There are no ifs nor ands about it. All those who had entered into my glory must and shall obey my law. And my law, as the Lord was treating it, is the law of plural marriage. And you can see why I think this is an important thing to address here. The 1886 revelation begins saying, you have asked me concerning the new and everlasting covenant and how far it is binding upon my people. Question is plural marriage the new and everlasting covenant? Brigham Young taught in 1868, all Latter-day Saints enter the new and everlasting covenant when they enter this church. It includes all of the covenants that we make, all of the ordinances, I believe. The 1886 revelation says, all commandments that I give must be obeyed. Is plural marriage always a commandment? And we've kind of addressed this already. in Jacob chapter 2, verse 30, the Lord says, "If I will, saith the Lord, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people." He's talking about commanding them to be polygamous, because earlier he'd said, be monogamists. But it's according to his will and how he will command his people, I believe. The 1886 Revelation says that we must and shall obey God's law. Is plural marriage an eternal law applicable to all people in all places and times? If we go to section 132, we find that it talks about this law. And verses 19 and 20 say that if a man marry a wife, by my word, which is my law, and by the new and everlasting covenant, and they live worthily, then shall they be gods. The promise of godhood is promised to a man and a wife, a singular monogamous marriage, if they live worthily. And it's interesting because when this verse is quoted in fundamentalist literature, which isn't very common, they add a bracket right here that says plural marriage, which is my law, bracket, plural marriage, other bracket. And yet that's not what it says. And we might not want to be putting words in the mouth of the Lord. In 1883, President John Taylor said, "God has told us about our wives and our children being sealed to us, that we might have a claim on them in eternity. He has revealed unto us the law of celestial marriage, associated with which is the principle of plural marriage." And I think this is the best way to look at it. We can find all kinds of references, and I don't know if Anne's going to kind of deal with this issue, but it's referred to as a lot of things, particularly between 1852 and 1890. But I like John Taylor, who's church president, understanding that there is a difference between the law of plural marriage and the law of celestial marriage and the principle of plural marriage. For me, the new and everlasting covenant encompasses the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, which encompasses the principle of plural marriage. The 1886 Revelation says that we must do the works of Abraham, and the question comes up, must a person practice polygamy to do the works of Abraham? Other questions, does plural marriage, regardless of the authority to seal the marriage, does it constitute doing the works of Abraham? Or more simply, does living a polygamous lifestyle constitute doing the works of Abraham? Well, Abraham did many good works. He sought for the priesthood. He presided righteously over his family. He paid his tithing. He kept his covenants. He received revelation. He was married by proper authority, we're told very specifically. And he practiced polygamy. And significantly, he offered up burnt offerings. It appears to me that God has, well, this is doctrine, God has not authorized or commanded Latter-day Saints to offer up burnt offerings at this time. And I believe similarly, and I think other church members agree, that God has also withdrawn his command and authorization to practice plural marriage in a similar fashion. The 1886 Revelation says that we must obey the conditions of this law. Is plural marriage a condition of the law? Well, we return to section 132, and we're not going to read this thing, but verse 7 begins by saying, "And verily I say unto you that the conditions of this law are these." And then we find a large discussion about the need for proper authorization through the one man who is on earth at a time, who has the keys of the power. There's no mention here of plural marriage as a condition of the law. Just in summarizing, and I don't want to misrepresent the fundamentalists, but it's been my impression that for them, for most of them, or at least some of them, the 1886 Revelation, in that revelation, references to the new and everlasting covenant is referring to plural marriage, or at least requires it. That the commandments discussed are plural marriage, and that those commandments could never be uncommanded. The law involved is the law of plural marriage. The conditions of the law require plural marriage, and doing the works also requires the practice of plural marriage. But my interpretation, and that I think shared by many church members, is that the new and everlasting covenant is all of the covenants entered into through baptism and the other ordinances. The commandments could be plural marriage, but plural marriage can be commanded or uncommanded. That the law is the law of celestial marriage, associated with is the principle of plural marriage. The conditions of the law always require proper authority, and that doing the works of Abraham is something we need to try to do so far as we are authorized and commanded, but we're not now authorized or commanded to sacrifice burnt offerings or to practice plural marriage. Personally, I think the greatest significance of the 1886 Revelation arises not from what it actually says, but from the reaction of a few church leaders to it. In trying to minimize its importance, they referred to it as a scrap of paper, as a pretended revelation. They implied it did not exist. Ironically, those efforts have greatly enhanced the perceived importance. Mormon fundamentalists have rallied in opposition to what they view as a cover-up. But really, what it says is not all that significant. The 1880, this is Michael Quinn, a historian. He concluded that the 1886 revelation, in my view, really added nothing to any of the revelations that had been given already on plural marriage. Just in closing, in 1878, Joseph F. Smith, I think, kind of summed it all up. He was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, and this is from the same talk that I quoted earlier that is real popular in Mormon fundamentalist literature. But at the beginning, he provides some context for those later comments, and he said at the beginning, he said, "There is a great deal said about plural marriage. It is a principle that pertains to eternal life, in other words, to endless lives or eternal increase. It is a law of the gospel pertaining to the celestial kingdom, applicable to all gospel dispensations when commanded and not otherwise, and neither acceptable to God or binding on man unless given by commandment, and I believe it can be commanded or uncommanded." We started by asking the question, is plural marriage required for exaltation? And let's just say that my discussion convinced no one, and not that I'm really here to convince anybody of anything, but we all still think or believe, or after Ann gets done with her meager 10 minutes, I wish she had more time, but that we all concluded that we need to be polygamists. I would submit that even if we all believed that, we were united, we could have a meeting or something, that none of us would be authorized to go off and practice plural marriage. Which gives us, I think, a better question, and this is a question addressed in my book, where are the keys of sealing, and is the one man who holds those keys allowing or encouraging plural marriage today? If you have other questions, go to MormonFundamentalism.com. I pick up the mail from that site. If you want to write me, I'll get back with you. Thank you.
Well, needless to say, we both come at this from a different perspective. When I read Brian's paper, which was 13 pages single-spaced, I thought, it's impossible to take this point by point and respond to it. So I thought, how am I going to approach this in my 10 minutes? So what I decided to do, if I were to be here till midnight tonight, I'd be glad to respond to every point. I'd have to do a little compiling of information first, but I could do that. But what I decided to do, since I'm a very optimistic, positive person, I decided to explain to you why I believe that celestial plural marriage is an essential for the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. I hope you understand what I just said in that statement. It's not just the celestial kingdom, it's not just plural marriage. They have adjectives to go with them to make that statement correct. In compiling and writing a book that I put out in 1998, it's called An Essential for Exaltation, Celestial Plural Marriage Essential for the Highest Degree of the Celestial Kingdom. By the way, this book's available, Benchmark Books, in the book room. I realized, first of all, that it's important to define the terms. As Brian mentioned, the terms have changed definitely, significantly through the years. In the early days of the church, plural marriage was used synonymously and interchangeably with patriarchal order of marriage, celestial marriage, and the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. They were just interchangeable. Today, of course, they mean something different. Celestial marriage means a monogamous temple marriage. Shortly after 1882, after the Edmonds Law, Franklin S. Richards showed how this definition had changed. And he stated that celestial marriage meant nothing more than being sealed to a single partner for eternity. This shift, however, was taken as one of several moves designed to lessen hostility toward the saints. That was quoted in Carmen Hardy's Solemn Covenant. Keeping in mind the definition changes, let's consider the following quotes concerning celestial plural marriage. To begin with, in Doctrine and Covenants 131, which I think is just as important as 132, it states, quote, In the celestial glory, there are three heavens or degrees in the celestial glory. And in order to obtain the highest, a man must enter into this order of the priesthood, meaning the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. And if he does not, he cannot obtain it. He may enter into the other, but that is the end of his kingdom. He cannot have increase. That sounds pretty plain to me. Okay, and in section 132, it says, "For behold, I reveal unto you a new and everlasting covenant. And if ye abide not that covenant, then ye are damned. For no one can reject this covenant and be permitted to enter into my glory." And as pertaining to the new and everlasting covenant, it was instituted for the fullness of my glory. And he that receiveth the fullness thereof must and shall abide the law or be damned, saith the Lord. Pretend for a minute now, and I know Brian quoted some of the early leaders of the church, but let's pretend that we've invited some of those early leaders to speak to us today and ask them this same question: is it essential? I really believe in my heart that they would answer that question just the same today as they would have done over 150 years ago. George Q. Cannon, Is it not a costly bargain which they are asked to make, to barter off all hope of eternal felicity with wives and children in the celestial presence of God and the Lamb for the miserable favor of the world? So intimately interwoven is that precious doctrine with the exaltation of men and women in the great hereafter that it cannot be given up without giving up at the same time all hope of immortal glory. George M. Cannon. Excuse me. John B. Cannon recalled that his father, George M. Cannon, took him aside in the library of their home and told him that polygamous living was a requirement if one wished to enter the highest level of the celestial kingdom. Abraham Hunsaker, in open day, a messenger from heaven with three women clothed in white raiment stood before him several feet above the ground and addressed him thus: "You never can receive a full and complete salvation in my kingdom," that identifies who's speaking, "my kingdom, unless your garments are pure and white and you have three counselors as you see me have." Heber C. Kimball, they, Joseph and Hiram, had to do the works of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in order to be admitted where they are. They had to be polygamous in order to be received into their society. Orson Pratt, there will be many who will not hearken. There will be the foolish among the wise who will not receive the new and everlasting covenant in its fullness, and they never will attain to their exaltation. Bathsheba Smith, wife of George A. Smith, President Woodruff, President Young, and President John Taylor all taught me, all the rest of the ladies here in the Salt Lake, that a man, in order to be exalted in the celestial kingdom, must have more than one wife, that having more than one wife was a means of exaltation. Joseph Smith, quoted by William Clayton, from him, Joseph Smith, I learned that the doctrine of plural and celestial marriage is the most holy and important doctrine ever revealed to man on earth, and that without obedience to that principle, no man can ever attain to the fullness of exaltation in celestial glory. Without it, polygamy, the highest glory could not be attained in heaven. Joseph F. Smith, and I won't go, because I think Brian quoted that, but he says that living celestial marriage monogamously is a fulfillment of the law in part, and that does not fulfill the entire law. Lorenzo Snow gave a little stanza of a song when he was in state prison in 1886, and he stated, "'Twas 1843, this sacred law was shown to me, which gives to men his loving wives God's only path to endless lives." Annie Clark Tanner, the principle of celestial marriage was considered the capstone of the Mormon religion. Only by practicing it could the highest exaltation in the celestial kingdom of God be obtained. In the interest of time, I better skip through some of the others, but in my book, I've got about 33 quotes that state that this is essential for the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. In many references, you'll note that, at least in my reading, I have noticed that plural marriage is referred to as an eternal law. I looked up eternal in the dictionary, and it says, without beginning or end, existing through all time, forever the same, always true or valid, unchanging, always going on, never stopping, timeless of eternity. Now, if a law is all those things, it doesn't seem to me like at one point it can be stopped and another point it can be started. True, the church can accept or reject it as a tenet or a practice of its faith. But as far as it being a law of God or the law of the priesthood, it is, in my opinion, an eternal law. It can be a law of the LDS Church when it is voted upon and accepted by the membership, which occurred in 1852. But keep in mind that Joseph Smith and many priesthood leaders lived plural marriage long before it became a law of the church. They lived it as a law of the priesthood. When the LDS Church membership voted in 1890 to no longer include plural marriage as a practice of their faith in the incorporated church, it still continued on as an eternal priesthood law. Wilford Woodruff took new wives, plural wives, after the manifesto, and many of the other church leaders. They did this in obedience to a law of the priesthood and separate from and outside of the recently accepted law of the church. I'm going to skip over that part. Frequently people will quote Jacob 2 as a reason for not living plural marriage. Well, they didn't do it in the Book of Mormon days. If you consider chapters 2 and 3 of Jacob in context, who are the people that are being spoken to? It says that if you look at the whole context, it goes on and on talking about the wickedness and pride of the people in that day. And then he makes a statement to these unrighteous people. That's who he's talking to. Quote, for there shall not any man among you, among the wicked that he's talking to, have save it be one wife. For behold, I, the Lord, have seen the sorrow and heard the mourning of the daughters of my people. So apparently that means to me that they were living plural marriage. The daughters were complaining and sorrowing. God heard their prayers. And then from that point on, at least for a while, he said, because of their wickedness and abominations, it appeared that he no longer required that of their hands. Thus it appears that the principle of plural marriage was no longer to be practiced among the wicked, but there's nothing that said about it being taken from the righteous. I should think it would be very difficult for God to watch his children on earth abuse such a sacred law as plural marriage. But just because he says it is no longer required among those who don't live it righteously, it does not mean that the entire law is revoked from everyone else. For example, would we as parents continue to loan an expensive automobile to our careless teenager when he does not value and care for it, and continually drives it recklessly and repeatedly damages it, risking not only his life but the lives of others? I would certainly hope not. But by telling this teenager he can no longer drive the car, it does not diminish the value of the car, nor does it prevent someone else from driving it who is more protective and deserving of the opportunity. Celestial plural marriage was never intended for everyone. Brian's statistics about percentages of men and women don't bother me at all, because those involved in this eternal principle would be such a small percentage of the total world's population that it would just be a drop in the bucket. In concluding, it's interesting to note that the word exaltation is mentioned only 12 times in the four standard works. 11 of those times are in section 132, referring to the law of plural marriage. In my estimation, it's very hard to picture section 132 as starting out talking about plural marriage, ending up talking about plural marriage when it talks about the law of Sarah, and in the middle it's talking about monogamy. I understand Brian's perception of that, but to me, that whole section of verse 132 is referring to plural marriage. Yes, I do believe that celestial plural marriage is essential for exaltation in the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, to be lived either in this stage of mortality or during the millennium. However, I emphasize celestial plural marriage, and Brigham Young said, if you remember, it will damn more people than it would ever save. Just because someone has lived this principle, either in biblical times, early church history, or today, does not automatically qualify them for exaltation. Where much is given, much is expected, and there's a tremendous responsibility that comes with living this principle. I'm grateful that the Lord is the judge, and I'm also very grateful that I was granted the opportunity and the privilege to live this principle for 33 years with an extremely righteous man whom I hope to spend eternity with. And I appreciate the blessings that I have already received from having lived it. Thank you.
In the time that we have left, we have time for question and answers. Please come to the mic so that we can record the questions as well as the answers.
I come and speak as a very conflicted person after hearing you talk. On one hand, I hear Brian telling us to ignore decades of pronouncements by church leaders that Anne's quoted, that polygamy is an eternal law of heaven, and those who are going to make the celestial kingdom have to live it. That's not the only instance in church history, I think, where we've had to turn our backs on things that have been said, but it's challenging to do it. Second, I hear Anne saying that it's only going to be a few that will really be living it, and to me it can only be a few. When you work the numbers, polygamy can't be universal practice, and we are talking about the gospel going throughout the world. The world can't practice polygamy with the numbers unless there's some miraculous way of changing those numbers, but that we've not seen in talking about heaven and births and all that sort of things here. So I'm just, and I guess then the third conflicted part is I personally respect Anne's testimony. I believe she genuinely has rejoiced in living polygamy. I cannot imagine practicing it. To me, even though George Hugh Cannon is my great grandfather, and he obviously felt otherwise, it just doesn't work for me. I mean, those are just comments I made.
Maybe the only thing that I would say that it is honestly my opinion, and I reserve the right to change that at any moment, that all of the men in the top of the celestial kingdom are not polygamists. I don't think the numbers are there. I think, personally, I don't want to be a polygamist. I think it would be very difficult. For me, the highest form of marriage is monogamy, but that's all I would say. That's my opinion.
Actually, I want to follow up with Toby's observation too. But I'm a highly conflicted person as well, but that for a whole lot of other reasons. Also, in terms of the numbers, I'm with Toby as well. I mean, the math doesn't add up. Brian, you alluded to that at one point. I'm going to challenge you a little bit. When you were walking through the math, you threw out, you know, the idea this is only going to work if the ratios of, you know, women who are more righteous than men works out. And you said, of course, it's obvious that women are more righteous than men. I would challenge that assumption. Some of the nastiest human beings I have known in my life are women. It is not a gender exclusive issue. I know of no empirical data, and I'm a behavioral scientist, I know of no empirical data to support that argument that it's obvious that women are more righteous than men as a gender. So I would challenge and question it. The other thing I would do is I would also challenge you to take these ideas and push them even further. I like a lot of your arguments that are rooted in a textual analysis of not only the canonized scripture, but also the quotations, many of which, and I've read through all those as well, and I'm familiar with them. There are some very strong moral arguments that have been made by writers in dialogue in other places, but a textual analysis of the scriptures on this topic of polygamy is a very good example of how, when we go to the scriptures with a view in mind of what the principle is, we are prepared to see that manifested in the text, whether it is objectively there or not. So I'll leave that out and let anybody react the way you want.
I don't have any response.
The issue of men and women being less or more righteous, I think in the church we have more single sisters that are active and involved, whether that means righteous or not. And I'm single and trying to find a wife, so I wouldn't want to say anything negative about that gender anyway. So,
right on the tail end of that, just so you know, there are only sons of perdition. Never is there any mention of daughters of perdition. So if that helps you out, Brian. My question is this. There's two examples that I think in history where we clearly see that the Lord has changed his mind. One is the flood. We read that Noah asked for something to happen to the people on account of their wickedness. So he goes, okay, I can put a little water on the earth. Then after that's cleaned up, he says, that was probably not such a great idea. Here's a rainbow. I won't do it again. The second one is blacks in the priesthood. If we are to assume that the Lord can never change his mind, does that mean that we must continue to think of African Americans as second-class citizens? Obviously, I don't think so. I think that there was a clear shift in that. The other thing that says to me is we need to look backwards and say that although men messed it up and denied blacks the priesthood, that they should have been accepted in full fellowship earlier than that, but weren't because of a commandment, which leads me to my question. Brian, you said, even if I was able to convince everyone in the entire room that we should be excited about polygamy, that we are still commanded not to live it today. And so I want to know, can I feel that polygamy is an eternal principle and not an eternal law? Even though we've been told to obey the laws of the land, and I think that's part of our articles of faith, that we need to make sure that even though we might feel certain things, obviously the principle of polygamy was never, ever, ever taken back. Even in the manifesto, it just said, stop living it, and Everett said, stop believing it. So I want to ask a question. Is there a hope that I can have that it's an eternal principle and not an eternal law because we've been asked to obey the laws of the land?
There's a million questions there. this is the thing here. The question about the laws of the land and the laws of God has been in existence since the beginning of time, and that's got to be an individual decision among people. And frequently they agree, and that's great. But right now they don't agree. And so people have to decide, is it more important for you to understand the laws of God as you understand them, or the laws of man? Right now, we are trying to get the law, the bigamy law, overturned and decriminalize it, bringing it a little bit more in coordination, the two of them. That's an ongoing process. I realize it's probably going to take longer than my lifetime, but it is something that we're working toward. But I can't say for you what's right for you. But to me, it was more important to me to live the laws of God as I understand them than the laws of man. But I do obey the laws of man wherever I possibly can.
And maybe I misspoke, but I think what I meant to say was that we cannot live this law today without proper authority. It's all an issue of authority. If for somehow President Hinckley were to start authorizing them, we might be able to do that. But I just don't think that we can freelance the effort and that God will bless it.
First, I want to say I really respect all the research that you've done, but there's some serious problems with it, which makes me question it all. What makes you think that there's only two accounts of the 1886 revelation?
What was there only what?
He said there were only two accounts of the 1886 revelation.
I said there were two histories. There was the one that Lauren Woolley remembered in the 1920s, and then there's the more generally accepted one that John W. Taylor mentioned. I think there's only one document out there that everybody's taking pictures of and quoting from, but Lauren Woolley remembered there were five copies made, which, and nobody's ever heard of those or referred to those that I'm aware of. If you have some more information, I'd love to hear it. But
there's a lot more information than that. There's many, many accounts on it. And the other problem I have is that you say it didn't have anything to do with plural marriage. When you take it in the context of the eight-hour meeting that took place before it was revealed, and different individuals had brought John Taylor a draft of a document very similar to the manifesto, and he had taken that to the Lord and asked him whether or not he should sign it, and in response to that he received that revelation. And so how can you possibly think it didn't have anything to do with plural marriage?
Well, you're reflecting. If you'll remember at the very beginning, I said there were three concerns that I have: sincerity, tradition, and personal revelation, that I don't think can authorize plural marriage. You're actually recounting in a very nice way Lauren Woolley's recollections from the 1920s, all of which I disbelieve. I think he was making it up. For me, Lauren Woolley was a storyteller. He's very sincere, a nice old guy. But well, and we need to talk, because I have done a lot of research trying to find anybody before 1920 who has referred to in any contemporary source this alleged meeting that you've talked about. I don't think it ever happened, and I'd love to have the evidence.
What about the account of Bateman, who was the guard, who stood guard and didn't let anyone come into John Taylor's room when he was that night, and who heard voices of him speaking underneath the... You have his account, you have some of the people that were there at the meeting's account, not...
No, we don't. Then provide those, because I've looked very hard for those, and so have other historians. Daniel Bateman, after 1920, after Lauren Woolley started to remember all these details, Bateman said, oh yeah, I was there, and they're all right, except I wasn't there for any ordinations. The only witness we have for the ordinations is Woolley, and I think that's significant.
Okay, and then the other problem I have is you said that people think that a man with more wives is more exalted than a man with less wives. And I don't think that you have any foundation for a statement like that from anyone other than disenchanted previous members of those groups, because that's absolutely not true. That's absolutely not true.
Well, and I agree with you that it isn't true, that having
more
wives doesn't...
It's not true that anybody believes that.
Well, the Kingstons do.
Absolutely not.
I've talked with them, and Paul Kingston is getting all kinds of extra wives and having lots of children. Is it just for fun then? Maybe I'm making an assumption that isn't justified. But
it's absolutely not justified. I am a tenth wife, and I don't in any way think that I'm more exalted than people who have less wives.
Well, I remember when Reuben Allred took his seventh wife, it was a real big deal among that group.
That's so the scripture that says in that day seven women will cling to the coats of one man. That's why seven was significant.
Actually, if you look at the context in which that happened, that they didn't talk about that. It was that Lauren Woolley said that to be the head of a dispensation, you had to have seven wives. That was the context from which I think they took that. Maybe they were quoting Isaiah. I don't know. And if I err in the assumption, then why are so many of the polygamists today wanting all these extra wives? I mean, what's the advantage? What's the eternal advantage to having three wives instead of two, or five instead of three, or 80 instead of 60?
I don't think that there is an advantage. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
I'm interested in the words that you had on the screen from the Lord, quoting the Lord, saying, "It is enough." I'm wondering if you mean to apply those words come from the writing of the manifesto from Wilford Woodruff, which we know from reading was written for political purposes, as it says in the manifesto, and that Wilford Woodruff was merely giving his advice, which is certainly nothing binding from the Lord. I'm just wondering if you could give the attribution from the Lord, "It is enough."
The quotation was from Wilford Woodruff, and I don't remember if I left the citation there. It's in my book, but Wilford Woodruff did refer to the manifesto as if it had been given in the words of "Thus saith the Lord." That's how he referred to it. Now, not everybody treated it that way. Joseph F. Smith in 1891 says, I don't think it's a command to stop plural marriage, but that's how Wilford Woodruff later referred to the Manifesto of 1890, was that it could be considered as if it had been given in the form of thus saith the Lord. And I can find you that quote if you want. I don't know if it's in that, but...
Isn't it interesting that we'll criticize Lauren Woolley for not coming out for several years with his account, but yet when Wilford Woodruff looks back on the manifesto and says, oh, this is a revelation, and yet he didn't say that at the beginning, then that's okay. As we know, the manifesto was really a press release given to the government. They did it at a time when they could vote on it at conference. It was issued and sent to the government 2 weeks before conference, and the government sent back and says, no, we don't want just your signatures on there. We want the whole people to vote on it, which they did, and it was not a unanimous vote. If you remember reading in Solemn Covenant, B.H. Roberts said, I could not raise my hand in support of that document. It was the awfulest day of my life. So just because the manifesto was voted on by the majority of the church doesn't mean it was unanimous, and doesn't mean it was a revelation.
And most, virtually everything she says is true, and I agree with all of that. The issue of the Manifesto of 1890, the most important thing is, how did that affect the one man who holds the keys? If it affected him, then it affected all of polygamy, I believe. So anyway, question.
Well, first I'd like to just point out that I've, for the topic and how its gravity and its weight, I guess, on religion and your both of your individual faiths, I just want to say that you two have a lot of respect for each other, and that's something I haven't seen in a debate, and so I appreciate that and the love that's here. And then just for the girl who was up here a minute ago, I think that the possible advantage, I know that there's always two sides to everything, the possible advantage of having more than, say, you have five plural wives versus two or three, the opportunity to perhaps have more posterity, more children, and therefore you're, you know, whatever you have in this life, that you'll be ahead of your fellow man in the next life, that could be it. You have more kids. And then what I wanted to ask is, do you know, Brian, the church's official stand on polygamy in the next life?
Well, we both
agree.
Because
this is a debate for mainstream, you know, Mormons, that a lot, I think, of women fear. My mom did. My friend's mom.
I can't even talk to my oldest daughter about it. She just goes ballistic. I believe, certainly there's polygamy there, as I mentioned earlier, that when we are saved as couples, you had to have polygamy, or there would be somebody at the end of the judgment who was worthy but not sealed, and they'd be damned, or something else. So you had to have plural marriage at that point. Did that answer the question?
Yeah. Okay. Now, is that a numbers thing, though, or just,
you know, I'll concede the numbers thing.
More women created.
Well, the more. Oh, I think we're done. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry to cut people off. We are over time. Thank you for coming out.